So welcome everyone to the last this year in our series of public events with Professor Martin Amis. We're delighted this evening that Professor Amis is joined by psychotherapist and writer Adam Phillips and the philosopher and academic John Gray. This event will be centred on the conversation, if you like, between literature and science as ways in which we interpret and understand our world. And I know we've got a lot of scientists and engineers in the audience tonight, so I think we've got a bit of a good mix. Just to introduce your panellists, as you all know, Martin Amis is one of Britain's leading novelists, and we're very proud that he's also Professor of Creative Writing at the University of Manchester's Centre for New Writing. He's someone who's often used science as a framework within which to explore ideas. I think he can also perhaps say that although he hasn't flinched from looking at the ways in which humanity can abuse science, he's also someone who has shown, if you like, an optimism about science and the possibilities that it offers humanity. Adam Phillips combines his highly regarded practice in psychotherapy with a similarly highly regarded practice as a thinker and writer, with books such as Side Effects, Going Sane, and Darwin's Worms to his name. He's the general editor of the New Penguin edition of the Selected Works of Freud, a reviewer and critic, and contributor to many publications, including the London Review of Books. And his writings deal with a lot of the big issues we face as people on the planet: the transience of life, how to construct meaning in the face of that, and the challenges of intimacy and of loss. I was struck, actually, in his book Darwin's Worms by his depiction of science, and it was Darwin's science, really. There's something that emerges from diligence and paying attention to data over long periods of time, in Darwin's case, many years. And I think that's something that rings very true if you're from a scientific background, as I am. And I'm sure a lot of you who've been at labs and benches today, crunching data, will recognise that. And it's something that's often lost in our cultural myth of the eccentric scientific genius. John Gray is a prominent political philosopher and emeritus professor of European thought at the LSE. His books on political theory include titles such as Al-Qaeda and What It Means to be Modern, and Straw Dogs, Thoughts on Humans and Other Animals. He writes regularly for many publications, including New Statesman and The Guardian. He often challenges the notion that science is modern and is an engine of progress, and in fact challenges the notion of progress within society. But he does that in a way that's quite empirical and therefore paradoxically quite scientific. And so I think with these panelists, we have an interesting evening ahead of us. What we're going to do is the panelists are going to speak for 5-10 minutes each, and then they're going to have a debate with each other about their ideas. And then we're going to open the debate up to the audience, and we have 2 radio mics that we'll move among you with. And so without further ado, I'd like to invite Martin to begin the evening for us. Thanks, Martin.
Thank you. Good evening. Now that we're all gathered here on this freezing night, it would feel glacial in a different way not to say something about what is already, I'm sure, occupying a significant fraction of your minds, the recent events in Mumbai. It was called Bombay when I was there. There's a delightful phonetic connection between these two words. And I know that Mumbai is the more ancient, and I'm not, of course, being patronizing, but whenever I say the two words together, Mumbai and Bombay, it always reminds me of my children's first attempts to say their names. You know, you'd say Jacob, and he'd say Jayput. You'd say Cleo, and she'd say Kiu. Say Bombay, and you can imagine a child saying Mumbai, as if the two words are inherent in each other. We're mere onlookers, but we're like Macbeth. We are in blood stepped in so far that were we to wade no more, to go back were as tedious as Goer. But I think something does strike one about this latest event. The usual prerequisite for a massacre is the notion that the victim is in some sense subhuman, Lenin called this animalization and took it further into insectization, that the victim is an anonymous representative of some group or creed or nation. The killers in Mumbai asked many of their victims, who were, by the way, overwhelmingly ordinary Indian citizens, for their names, their nationalities, their type of employment. As an Indian writer, Anand Giridharadas, wrote in the New York Times, it was as if they wanted to taste the terror, to personalize it. And one could say that they refreshed their sense of their victim's individuality before extinguishing it. So let's think of them, because we already are thinking of them, and the concentric circles of grief that emanate from each one of the dead. Literature and science, a vast subject. Our guests tonight are so redoubtably distinguished that I don't expect to say much or indeed understand much during our talk. John Gray is a philosopher of politics and thought. Adam Phillips, broadly speaking, a philosopher of what used to be called the unconscious. But they are both writers, and in the sense that they are both contributors to the order of words we call literature. And they have something in common, I think. It is a fertile tentativeness, not only non-ideological, but non-teleological, telos, meaning end or destination. I think they would both agree with Nabokov that it is silly to look for the answer to everything, and even sillier to find it. But here's a big idea, and very approximate one. In the beginning, literature was about gods. Then it was about demigods. What a falling off was there when the protagonist only had one divine parent. Then about kings and queens, then about great soldiers and statesmen and fabulous lovers. Then about the middle classes. Then about the everyman and everywoman of modernity. Until we reached the recent past known as the Ironic Age. And literature stopped looking up and stopped looking levelwards and started looking down. This descent or arc is a response, in a way, to science, to human knowledge. What a terrible blow it was to discover that we were not the center of the universe or the galaxy, or even the solar system. That the sun orbits the Earth was once a delusion, and is still an illusion. But this heliocentricity was a stinging blow to human self-esteem. Perhaps Adam Phillips will talk about this, but it remains true that human beings, blundering, wheezing, sweating, excreting, earth-locked, still have inside them cosmic yearnings. We aspire not to Godhead, perhaps, but like Eve in the garden, who ate from the tree of knowledge because she wanted promotion above the mere human, aspiring not to Godhead, but to perhaps angeldom. If you remember, there are 9 orders of angels, and we would perhaps not hope to be cherubim, whose love of God is said to be perfect and entire, but we would probably, being ambitious creatures, aim for being seraphim, the seraphim are to be imagined as always aspiring upwards, like a flame, to perfect knowledge of God. And this is what Pope had in mind in the great line, as the rapt seraph that adores and burns. So the history of human aspiration and literature and science has really been one of increasing humiliation for the species. Disappointment is the word, etymologically, because it means not dashed hopes, but the removal of from a position, to be disappointed. And where are we now? I hesitate to say this in this company, but it seems that cosmology has ground to a halt, perhaps a generation ago, with superstrings theory that resembles very much a kind of pseudoscience in that it can't be falsified or verified. And we're coming to realize, and this seems to me more and more ominous and weighty, that that we are not intelligent enough as a species to understand the universe. So we can't even disprove or prove the non-existence of God. We have followed, in fact, the arc of that writer, J.G. Ballard, who started off as a science fiction writer and wrote some of the best hard SF stories you'll ever read, but then realized that his destiny as a writer was to move from outer space to inner space. And perhaps that's where the future lies. I don't like to use the word progress sitting next to John Gray, but I think that a plausible future for the novel, certainly, it's a sort of inheritance of Darwin, neuroscience, developmental psychology. It's said that Einstein used to read, as part of his daily work, he used to read philosophy of science to learn the implications of his own discoveries. I now understand that scientists never read philosophy of science, that they're in some certain sense out on their own and not looking for guidance from philosophy. And it seems to be very probable that the novelist will partly take up this role. As the nature of the self is, of course, always changing, but the nature of the structure of the human being is likely to become more mechanical, more like a machine with various insertions and customizations that science will make possible. But meanwhile, writers do what crazy scientists and totalitarians have always tried to do, but we do it non-invasively and only metaphorically. That is to say, we recreate what it is to be human. Thank you very much.
Following on from... Can you hear me? No? Can you hear me now? Oh, dear.
Do you want to use mine?
You might have fallen off.
I don't think this is a failure of science.
Do you mind using them?
You can hear that. I suppose just following on from what Martin was saying, one of the things that interests me to discuss, and maybe we'll discuss it, that has been the legacy of science maybe in the last 100 years, is why it has been disillusioning to discover that we are, in fact, animals. Not like animals, but are animals. That why it's what kind of disillusionment it's been that we are simply in nature. There's nothing else that we can be in. When the topic of science and literature turned up, it seemed, as Martin said, such an enormous subject that I thought I wanted to say something about how it's actually impinged upon my life. Because I had effectively a literary education in the 60s and 70s. I grew up believing more or less in a sort of anti-technological, vaguely anti-scientific, pro-D.H. Lawrence view of the world, which effectively meant that literature was true in the way that mattered most, but one was obviously still grateful there were anesthetics and so on. But the great thing about literature was that there was no progress in it, that there wasn't a project necessary to make things truer, even though one might want to make things better. And for me, I think that was very important early on, that there was real progress in science, and in the arts, that wasn't an issue. Similarly, by the same token, I was always struck by the fact that if you were reading, say, Middlemarch, and you made a jotting in the margin, you weren't writing literature. Whereas if you read a philosophy book and made a jotting in the margin, you were probably writing philosophy. And maybe the same is true of science, I don't know. But the science or literature question, which never seemed to me to be a really important one, because certainly most of the literature that I read and liked, even if it was also anti-science, was very interested in science, both as a methodology and in terms of discovery and wonder. There was an appropriate named philosopher called John Wisdom, who was in Cambridge in the 30s and 40s, and he told a story about the man in charge of the lion house in Dublin Zoo. There was a period, apparently, in the 30s and 40s when the lions in Dublin Zoo thrived like lions nowhere else in the world. And this man bred lions and kept a really large number of them. When he was asked, you know, what's the secret? What do you know about lions? He said, every lion is different. Now, I think for me, literature has always been about singularity. Whether it's been the attempt to realize the singularity of character in fictional drama or the singularity of a voice in lyric poetry. Which isn't to say, of course, that science isn't specific. But it's very striking in psychoanalysis because if you read, for example, Freud's studies in hysteria, he writes these case histories, but he discovers as he's writing them that they sound like short stories. And the question is, why would that be a problem? You could think this is rather wonderful. He does this work, and it's as though it's material to write short stories out of. But actually, Freud is very perplexed. And the reason he is perplexed is because if they're like short stories, there's a sense in which they're not usable. That is to say, they can't be used by other practitioners as exemplary instances. They're not how-to books. And this, I think, is where singularity comes in and where the fact that every lion is different comes in. Because when you train to be a psychoanalyst, you're taught two things. One is that everybody's history is full of contingency and made up of accident, or made up of a sort of interrelation between accident and desire. So there's a profound idiosyncrasy that is stressed by Freud, and yet it devolves into a very limited number of possibilities in terms of relationship. So that there may be X number of people in the world, but Freud at least believes everybody has an Oedipus complex. And what he means by that is that because we've all had a parent of each sex, and because we can't help but live in triangles, whether or not our parents are present or absent, that actually there are generalizable typologies. So when you're actually treating a so-called patient, all the theories you have are generalities, and yet the experience you have is of somebody very singular. And certainly when you train, what's very striking is that when you start talking to somebody, they're very easy to fit into the categories and generalizations you've been taught. The more you talk to them, the less you are able to do this. In fact, what seems to happen the longer one spends in somebody's presence is the generalities and the, if they are this, the equivalent of laws of nature seem to disappear, except in their most rudimentary forms. I mean, there are basic developmental unfoldings, for example, that everybody crawls, stands, talks, etc., feeds themselves. But other than a very basic biological unfolding, the degree of variance and variability is extraordinary. So very soon, as a psychoanalyst, you can't help wonder what you're actually doing. Because you have theories about human beings that are derived, that are generalizations, that are as close to scientific as they can be, and yet you have a person in front of you who is dissolving the categories the more they speak. So I think that one of the things about psychoanalysis is it's a kind of symptomatic cultural project in terms of our subject tonight, because on the one hand, it wants to believe in progress and generality and laws of nature, And what it keeps finding is, as it were, an internalized cross-current within the individual, that the individual feels themselves to be both simply of a species and yet very, very obscurely and enigmatically idiosyncratic. So I think that's the bit that interests me. Thank you.
Does it work? Can you hear me clearly, or do I need to use that? Can you hear me?
Can you hear?
Yeah, okay, then I don't need to use it. What I have to say, I think, follows on pretty directly from both what Martin said and what Adam said, which is I've been interested in the way in which science, the activity of finding out more about how the world works, understanding it better, controlling it better, predicting things better, even explaining things better, got used as a part of a kind of project of human liberation, human redemption, even human salvation. And one of the writers I've found most interesting in this connection is H.G. Wells, and a great Edwardian turn-of-the-century writer, wrote his great scientific fables in 4 years, the most famous ones, at the end of the 19th century. And for him, as for most people at the time, science meant Darwin. Science meant Darwinian biology. And he was acutely conscious, as it were, of the implication of Darwin's thought, which is that humans are animals, as Adam said, not like animals or animalish, but we are a species of animals. And he began to think of science as a way of lifting itself out of its animal condition, ceasing to be governed by instinct, ceasing to be simply part of a natural order of procreation and death, and becoming something quite different. And science was going to do this, but at the same time, interestingly, he, right from the start, in his journalism, before he became a writer of science fiction or these scientific romances or fables for which he's so famous, but also in the fables themselves, he doubted that the use of science by unregenerate human animals would have this result. And in, I think, his greatest fable, certainly his darkest, which I urge you all to read, it's in print and easily obtainable, the Island of Dr. Moreau, he imagines an island on which a vivisectionist is practicing various types of surgery and grafting on animals with the goal of turning them into humans. And Dr. Moreau sees this as part of a project of humanizing animals, but it's also, in Moreau's mind, part of a project which could be used later to humanize humans. Because for Wells, what human salvation, human redemption, human liberation meant was, as he put it, burning the animal out of humanity, burning the animal soul out of humanity through pain, through various kinds of experiment, which involved a great deal of pain. And of course, the thing about Moreau's, The Island of Dr. Moreau, a book which has been turned into several rather bad films, is that Moreau fails. The beast folk, he creates these horrible hybrids, tormented, deranged creatures, rise up against Moreau, and the whole experiment collapses. The narrator goes back to civilization and finds himself in civilization surrounded by creatures, ordinary humans, who it seems to him, having witnessed the experiment, are very like the hybrid creatures, the beast folk, as they're called, in that Moreau created from his experiments. Now, why is this interesting? Why is Wells's fable interesting? I mean, it is a fable. It's something rather deep. I would say it's a myth, actually, one of the very few true modern myths. So it has a lot of potentially contradictory readings or meanings in it. Well, why I find it interesting, and I'll fill this in quite briefly with some further material about Wells in a moment, why I find it interesting is that Wells in his public life, and in, if you like, in his conscious view of himself, was committed to the idea that progress in science, that's to say in knowledge, which he thought was real and I think is real, progress in knowledge, the growth of knowledge, is real. There is genuine progress. We do know far more than we did in the past. There is genuinely cumulative advance in science. He thought that progress in knowledge could be used to transform and elevate humanity so that it ceased to be a mere animal, maybe ceased to be any kind of animal. That was his kind of his public project. And he visited the revolutionary leaders of the of his time, talked to Lenin, who regarded him as a boring little bourgeois, rather the way the snobbish English writers in American writers like Henry James regarded him. He later on talked to Stalin, talked to Roosevelt, and wrote an enormous amount of popular science, encyclopedias, histories of knowledge, histories of humanity, in which the key theme, if you like, is that knowledge can emancipate humanity from its condition of being a mere animal. And yet, in his fable, The Island of Dr. Moreau, and in his other fables, all point in a completely different direction. They point to the direction in which progress in knowledge is not, and perhaps cannot be, replicated as progress in life, progress in ethics, progress in politics. So we have genuine progress, undeniable progress in science, in knowledge. But the attempt which he made throughout his life, remember his fables, Moreau was written in, published in 1896, and Wells died in 1946. And in the meantime, between those two dates, he was incessantly active as a propagandist, as a reformer, generating all kinds of projects for world government, a world state, universal encyclopedias, all kinds of things, as part of his overall project of using knowledge to change human life so that it's no longer what he thought of as mere animal life, but something higher. And yet, in his fables, and at the very end of his life as well, he concluded what his fables had sort of intimated back there in the 1890s, that knowledge couldn't have this result. The reason it couldn't have this result is so interesting to explore. One is that knowledge, one reason he identified is that knowledge is used by human animals as they are. That's to say, the human animal acquires more and more knowledge, but uses it for its own purposes. There were many examples of that in his time. For example, Stalin, I don't know whether Wells knew this, but Stalin actually did commission a project of developing a super soldier, a new type of human being, a super soldier that, unlike actual human soldiers, would need less sleep, less food, would be harder and tougher, and wouldn't have the human responses of sympathy that even trained professional soldiers have. He plucked a so-called scientist, I think, who actually was a horse trainer from the Tsarist period, out of nothing, gave him a lot of money to set up an institute in Georgia, Stalin's home part of Russia. And this man went around the world collecting various unfortunate apes and also collected various unfortunate humans who were described as volunteers. And he had them copulate, ape-human hybrids. Well, surprise, surprise, they didn't produce anything. They didn't produce. So that kind of thing was going on in the 1930s. And Wells himself had actually, in his nonfiction, his propaganda, had advocated it in 1901, that's to say 5 years after the publication of Moreau, The Island of Dr. Moreau, Wells published a book called Anticipations, which is what he thinks should be done, how he thinks scientific knowledge should be used by the new world state, by the new elite. And it's chilling reading in many ways, because what he says is, very like what Moreau said, almost in the same tone of voice. He says, well, one of the things we have to do is get rid of inefficient peoples. a lot of inefficient people cluttering up the earth. He says, is there any room for them in the future? He said, I must tell you frankly, no. And I don't think he meant by get rid of them, just educate them. He meant remove them. It's not an uncommon view in Edwardian times, but it's kind of rather chilling. So what is the, there's a very sort of fascinating disjunction here between what Wells publicly, and I would say for most of his life, actually believed with his conscious understanding of himself, which is that science could be used, the growth of human knowledge could be used to elevate humanity from the condition of being a mere animal. That's what he believed nearly all of his life, consciously. And what his early fables, and at the end, and I'll finish myself now, at the very end of his life, he concluded, his early fables suggest that the growth of knowledge simply is used by humans to pursue their human, Wells would say animal, their human goals of power, but also to pursue various kind of dreams of that they have of, about how they might change themselves. And the result, though, is not anything like what they dream of. The result is a nightmare of various kinds. Terrible wars, terrible times of torture and mass murder, totalitarianism. That's what comes from using human knowledge. Of course, lots of good things come too. Longevity, more prosperity in some contexts, anesthetics. But side by side with that, and inevitably, inexorably, Wells came to believe, all these other aspects, the horrific aspects, are inevitably bound up with the human use of growing knowledge because human knowledge is used by the human animals. So the situation of the human being cannot be remedied by knowledge. And at the end of his life, he wrote a book called The End of the Tether. He was sick by then. He had diabetes, cancer. He'd had tuberculosis as a young man. He had lifelong illnesses of one kind and another. So he was exhausted. So this might partly be, as it were, an expression of this exhaustion. But in this last book, which was called Mind at the End of His Tether, he said this is the last thing he'll ever say. He says that this dream that he'd had throughout his life comes to nothing. He thought that the human species was, as it were, locked in to its own destructive activities and would soon, he thought, disappear. Now, of course, it didn't. The humans blundered on, for better as well as for worse. So he was wrong about that. But what is interesting is to see this, to me, this duality, this disjunction in Wells between the view of science as opening up the possibility of an almost magical transformation of human life in which it ceases to be merely animal or animal at all. And on the other hand, the view of science as something which adds to human power, the power of humans to do things to the world and each other and themselves, but doesn't, as it were, unriddle the singularity of human lives. It leaves that, as it were, before, or even more, perhaps, indecipherable. And this is connected with, as it were, the disjunction I mentioned earlier, or the discrepancy between what is, I think, just a fact, despite what postmodernists or relativists say, the fact of cumulative growing knowledge in science, various types of science, on the one hand, and the lack of cumulative advance in ethics and politics. So this kind of disjunction is what interests me in the relationship between science and literature, because on the whole, literature has not presupposed that kind of cumulative, step-by-step advance. Science has and actually demonstrates it in genuine scientific knowledge. But even more, science has been embraced in the culture, not only by Wells, but by most modern, many modern writers and many, many modern politicians, as a way in which the cumulative growth of knowledge can be replicated as a cumulative advance in ethics and politics so that life can get, as it were, better and better. At the end of his life, Wells concluded that that disjunction was a myth and that there was no truth in it at all.
So perhaps, can you hear me? Perhaps, Martin, you'd like to lead off and start the conversation.
Sure. I think
interesting to think in what sense the human beings are animals, but what is the great distinction between our species and all the others? And this sort of brings us all together in that it's the awareness of death. As Borges has written, every animal is immortal except for man. As he further says, time is a river that bears me away, but I am the river. It was 30, 40 years ago, it was the main tenet, perhaps, of psychology that it was the knowledge of death that makes us almost Morrow-like and tortured and stricken creatures, because we know that death will come to us, and from this all art stems, because it's a sort of immortality. As Milton said, love of fame, meaning immortality, that last infirmity of noble minds. Do we take this as a defining difference between us and other species?
It's like being in a very paradoxical position in which we're the animals who believe we have to learn how to be animals or learn to be better at being animals. And one of the things I think raised by what John was saying as well is this question of, at its most rudimentary, what's worth knowing about? That's to say, if there's a huge disjunction between the knowledge that's accumulated and our own animality, it then must make us wonder something about the sentences we're most moved by or the sentences we're most intrigued by. I mean, the fact that we can think about death or indeed think about being born or produce descriptions of any of these things in the light of sort of Darwinian natural selection and so on, we're always left with the question, well, what's the point of knowing that? What's the use of knowing that? And it looks as though an awful lot of the knowledge that's been accumulated has been a kind of unconscious, or not so unconscious, attack on animality, which is why the Island of Dr. Moreau is so interesting, because it's as though the problem of being an animal is that you're an animal, as though there was something else you could be. So for me, it seems to me we're involved in a sort of historical de-escalation of having... It's as though we all got the wrong idea a very, very, very long time ago and thought there was something else you could be other than an animal. And now we have to unlearn or learn something else about being an animal, where, of course, as John said and Martin's intimated, it's a very paradoxical idea, the idea that you have to learn to be an animal. We must be the only animals who think of it like that.
Well, I guess, yeah, I agree with that entirely. I mean, it is highly, I share that thought entirely, it's very highly paradoxical. But, I mean, there's an enormous amount in our cultural tradition that is based on the belief that we need to learn how to live. We need to learn how to be a successful or flourishing animal. I mean, in a sense, Greek philosophy, Greek ethics, was all about that. I suppose Greek ethics in Socrates and others started the idea that knowledge was inherently good. So the question, what's worth knowing, didn't arise for Plato, didn't arise for Socrates, or perhaps it arose because there were sophists who... and other philosophers around at the time, cynics and Epicureans, who actually questioned the idea, who said actually knowledge is good if it promotes pleasure, not otherwise. But the idea that carried on and entered our way of thinking about these things, entered our lives, if you like, was that knowledge is good. The good life is the examined life, is a very deeply rooted notion, which also... I think, in a different way appears in psychoanalysis. That if you don't examine your life, you can't have a good life. If your life is wholly unexamined, well, it might be a reasonably happy or contented life, but it's not the sort of life humans should live. Humans should live examined lives. They should stand back from their instincts and conventions and traditions and needs and impulses and somehow question them and shape them then according to some different ideal which reflects greater knowledge. So this is a very, very powerful idea, and yet, of course, it's not the only idea in our culture, because in the myth of Genesis, which Martin mentioned, we have a different idea in which knowledge appears partly as a temptation, but also in a way almost as a form of oppression. So that the idea is not so much that we produce knowledge because we want to do various things with that knowledge, but that knowledge gets produced, and then it gets produced more and becomes cumulative, and that process creates a whole variety of problems or dilemmas. Problems suggest they're insoluble, by the way, but they may not be.
But there's, I'm sure you know, but there's one bit of knowledge, isn't there, that's sort of integral to our progress myths, which is in psychoanalysis as well, which is one thing that's supposedly very good to know is that there really are other people in the world. So that in a psychoanalytic developmental story, it's as though the child's struggle is to get to a point where it can acknowledge that the mother that it needs is not under its remote control. So that one of the fundamental problems of knowledge is to do with waiting, is being able to represent to yourself what you need, articulate it to somebody else, and be able to bear the frustration of not getting exactly what you want. That could be a basic bit of structural knowledge. But you could end up thinking something like, people who are good at waiting are only good at waiting because they've got nothing better to do. Or you could think, well, if you believe too much in the existence of other people, you're likely to become extremely frustrated and therefore even more murderous and enraged. So it seems to me this is a kind of example of where ethically, probably, if there's a we in this room, we'd all agree that we have to have some belief that other people are independent of our needs in relation to them. But on the other hand, that very belief and that knowledge which we've all painfully acquired could itself be a problem in our own survival, which is one of the reasons I think the Freud wants to be counter-Darwinian and say, actually, there may be something more important than our own survival, which is our own pleasure-seeking. So it's not as though, from Freud's point of view, there's a part of oneself that prefers risk to safety. It's as though there's a part of ourselves that has doesn't use that vocabulary at all. There's just part of ourselves that wants to gratify itself. And then there are all sorts of other, as it were, morally, other parts of oneself built upon that, that are to do with, it seems to be fundamentally, the knowledge of the existence of other people. And see, and one of the things that the science of psychoanalysis has put a question mark over is, what are useful things to know about another person? Because clearly, for example, there are ways of knowing people that make them less desirable to oneself. There's clearly something very regressive about intimate relationships because people get to know each other so well that they no longer desire each other. They become familiar to each other. So there's an example of counterproductive knowledge. But would the consequence of that then be we should try hard not to know each other if we want to be really excited by each other?
Well, a paradox, I mean, it runs right through, doesn't it? Because what we're talking about, even in politics, I mean, it would be hard to imagine, not impossible, I suppose, you could say something like the Inquisition was an attempt to close off knowledge. Although at the time, although, you know, there are examples of early astronomy, actually, having read a bit about it recently, what the Inquisition was worried about, it lasted a long time, of course, centuries, but what it was worried about a lot of the time wasn't so much knowledge but doubt. Because for most of the time, there wasn't all that much scientific knowledge growing up. It was worried about people coming along and doubting things, saying, well, is there really such a thing as natural law which says we all have to get married in this sort of way? Are humans really the way Christianity is? Has taught us they are. It was doubt which threatened that. Doubt, as it were, threatened singularity. It threatened people living in a variety of ways and trying out different types of life and so on. It removed the barriers to that. But the reason I mentioned the Inquisition was it's sort of hard to imagine
except as a form of Taliban-like or Inquisition-like totalitarianism, the idea of curtailing knowledge, because in a sense, if we curtail it, we know what we're curtailing. We could perhaps curtail the knowledge of future generations by burning books or destroying laboratories. But it would be a very odd kind of thing to do, like saying, I'm not going to get to know this person very well, because if I do, I'll like them less well. I'll learn too much about them. I might learn as much about them as I already know about myself. And that would be very unfortunate. So,
but every culture and every individual has a category of unacceptable, don't they? I mean, we might say as Democrats, we really want to get to know what we all think. But there are limits. There are points beyond which people can say things or be things for us that are absolutely unacceptable or too frightening to be bearable. So, in a sense, we're all the time putting brakes on knowledge, as well as saying we really should get to know each other.
Are there different kinds of knowledge here, though? Because the kind of knowledge we put brakes on, I'm not now thinking about arguments about stem cells research or whatever. It's a certain type of personal or autobiographical knowledge, isn't it? And is that knowledge cumulative? Well, I guess since there is such a thing as disappointment or disillusionment.
Or shame.
Or shame or de-romanticization or something like that, it can be cumulative in a person. But not otherwise, is it? In other words, one of the key things about scientific knowledge, almost the key thing, is that it is cumulative across persons and across generations. It grows. We know.
Well, scientists don't seem to be ashamed of what they're doing, whereas writers can be.
Could we perhaps bring up the question of pseudoscience? There is no shadowy brother of literature called pseudo-literature. I mean, there's a lot of, in the Sue's Corner sense, but there is not this dangerous twin or sharer. And the great attempts to transform the human being have all been reliant on various pseudosciences. Stalin, for instance, in longevity, he had a particular quack that he was convinced was going to make him live to the until he was 150. And it's sobering to think that Stalin would now be 125 and still with us. The longevity expert died at the age of 59, and Stalin limped on to 73. But It's almost as if, and tell me if there's truth in this, that the discoveries of Einstein and Freud, the sort of so-called Jewish science, were so astounding to certain mindsets that there was a great revolt against reason brought about by this. If human beings were so strange, if the universe was so strange, so it's a profound, intensely counterintuitive, bending light and the fact that two objects heading towards each other at the speed of light still had a combined speed of the speed of light, that you then, there was an immersion in various pseudosciences, Lysenkoism, which went against Darwin, and the entire Nazi project with its absurd racial theories. There was a department of the Reich, of the state, that was looking into trying to prove that the Aryans weren't descended from the primates, but were descended from an ice cloud that had formed in the city of Atlantis, and there were so-called serious scientists trying to establish this. The great apotheosis of fascism came in, I think, 1943 when Mussolini fell, and Stalin was trying to find out where he was before he sort of reinstalled him. And German astrologers and palmists and telepathic experts were put to work to establish this. What is this? Eugenics, for instance, and nanotechnology may turn out to have a sort of sinister inheritance for us. What is this no, of course, no equivalent with literature or art, but this sort of black mass of science.
Well, it's a very, very interesting question, and a kind of quite a complicated one as well, because one of the things about Nazi racism is that it did claim to be scientific. It did claim to be rational. And there was an awful lot of racist anthropology before Nazism. The British Association of Anthropology was, I think, held, the leading members of it, held to varieties of scientific racism, so-called, for a long time. So they didn't see themselves as rebelling against reason. They saw themselves as applying, not only the Nazis, but also, well, for example, one of the teachers of the Nazi experimenters, the hideous Nazi experimenters in the concentration camps, one of the teachers was a man who did his first experiments in Africa on Africans, on the Hereros, which were an African people which was almost wiped out by the German colonial powers, partly through mass shootings and starving and also primitive types of biological warfare, but some of them were actually, and large-scale deaths in camps, which were concentration camps, which were set up in Africa before the First World War, but also in so-called scientific experiments. So racism, scientific racism, antedates the Nazis and feeds into the Nazis directly, even through certain specific people who then were luminaries of scientific racism. So this was a tradition within, a malign tradition within science. And what's sort of interesting is when we say something is pseudoscience, what do we mean? I don't think we just mean erroneous science. We don't just mean science that was sort of turned out to be wrong. We mean, we don't think of earlier phases of scientific theory throughout history as all being pseudoscience. We think of them as, many of them as...
alchemy and astronomy.
Well, of course, some people do say things. I mean, you could say, many people would say alchemy was pseudoscience. On the other hand, if you look back at the origins of early modern European science, you find that many of the great figures in that were alchemists. Yeah. Magicians, or in the case of Newton, a bit later, fundamentalists, as we would now say. So that I think it's very tricky, actually, to say what distinguishes. I mean, people like Popper have tried it, which is, just to give an example, another Viennese like Freud. He was against Freud, he was against Adler, he was against Marx, and because he said it's not science, it's all pseudoscience, because we have to apply a kind of single test of falsification. If these are not falsifiable theories, they're not science. To which many historians and sociologists have replied, well, if you apply that rather rigorously, you won't end up with very much.
But it is a question of criteria, isn't it? Because I think there is a link here between pseudoscience and literature, which is rhetoric, which is the power of persuasion. And you could think that if there's an idea of pseudoscience, then there is a group of people who believe they have a consensus about the criteria for real science. And there's going to be a kind of contest of rhetorics here. So it's not about correspondence, where this turns out to be predictably right. It's much more to do, I think, with the way the language works. And that seems to me to be a very enigmatic thing. Not that people believe things that are false, so to speak, but that they can persuade a great number of people to agree with them such that they, to all intents and purposes, become true in the sense of consensual truths.
Not only lots of other people, but themselves.
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
But themselves, yes. Because I guess one of the ways, I mean, the one period I've read a bit about is the early Soviet period. I mean, from the revolution up into the early days of Stalinism. And there was masses of pseudoscience around at the time, on any understanding, not just Lysenkoism, that was the most... that was a bit later, but it started, I think, earlier on in Pavlov's work was recruited to develop a kind of Soviet science. Most of it was, though not Pavlov's work itself, perhaps, but was pseudoscience. But what made it pseudoscience? And I guess it's partly the way in which it was used, not only used, because that implies, in a sense, some group that didn't believe in it but used it, but was used in the lives of those who did believe it, at least for a while, as a way of promoting
some kind of, if you like, however perverse the ethics were, ethical vision. That's to say, going back to what we were talking about earlier, science was going to be used to elevate, and not just elevate, not just eliminate poverty, not just enable people to live longer, but to transform human beings.
Transformative.
It was transformative. It was going to, if science was, as it were, incorporated into human life, fully incorporated, then humans would be different from what they'd ever been in the past. Mm.
And they are. It's partly true. Things they've never been able to do before, but they're still animals.
But they're not different in the ways in which these people wanted them
to
be different.
No, they're not different in kind.
No.
But there was a kind of revolt against reason, and it's extraordinary how in the speeches of Stalin, Lenin, and Hitler, the word reason is never allowed to go past without a pejorative adjective like cowardly or abject reason, cowardly reason, miserable reason. And it wasn't the idea that once you discredit reason, then anything becomes possible. Mm. And it was Stalin's habit during the war to ring up munitions suppliers at the sort of ministerial level and say, I want this much lead in Minsk tomorrow, without regard to the objective conditions. Mm. meaning, I don't care if it's impossible. But it was truly transformative in that, as I was saying earlier, that people say, were these regimes totalitarian? And of course, no regime can be. But they were totalitarian in their ambitions for the species, and they wanted to create a new kind of person. And it was, I think, Trotsky, you know, easily the most intelligent, and though not nearly the most ruthless, who imagined a future Soviet Union where every individual would be a Shakespeare and a Beethoven. Such would be the extent of the transformation.
But Trotsky would have said, in fact, he did say in the pamphlet, I think that's in his pamphlet, Politics and Literature, if I'm not mistaken, he would have said that he's applying scientific knowledge.
Yeah.
I mean, the difference between Trotsky and the Nazis is that Trotsky wasn't a racist. I mean, the Nazis believed in racial science, the pseudoscience. Trotsky didn't. But that didn't mean Trotsky wasn't, as it were, using science. I think he did think that science could and should be used. So did Gorky, by the way. There are one or two letters from Gorky in which he says Gorky was put on the board of an institute for experimental science. He says the main thing about this institute is we've got to get over our inhibitions about using human subjects. We've got to use human subjects in scientific experiments, even terrible ones, even fatal ones, to advance knowledge, because the result of that could be a better species, a new species, a different species, a species which isn't just an animal species. So there was a revolt against reason, and particularly, I think, in Nazism and in Stalin's behavior, I think you're quite right. If you say, and of course, it was later on in Mao as well. So, well, we can't do that, actually. We can't plant on this area. The reason Tibetans have never grown wheat in this area is it can't be grown. Nonsense, you'd say. The human will, the human can do it. So then there was a huge famine, and people died on a large scale. So there is that kind of, but there is always the backup of, even in Mao, even in Stalin, and in a certain kind of way in Hitler, because if you ask what was Hitler's worldview, it wasn't traditional religion of any kind. It was a sort of pastiche common among autodidactic Central European half-literate people, a pastiche of Nietzsche and vulgarized Darwinism. In other words, it was a sort of pastiche of reason and unreason, if you like.
Reason itself is a rhetorical term, isn't it?
Yes.
It's not that we all know what it is. It's used very specifically in that sense. Yeah. Pseudo-literature, I presume, is propaganda.
Mm. But it's a good point about rhetoric being a kind of pseudo literature, but then doesn't that immediately the psychology of crowds takes over the, and peer group, and I'm more and more convinced that the peer group pressure can make people do anything. There was the model for this is a phenomenon known as Police Battalion 101, which was a dad's army of scoutmasters and school teachers who were sent from Germany to the Eastern Front and spent their time machine gunning men, women, and children and burying them in pits and all the rest of it. And there were very, very few people who asked to be transferred. And if you did ask to be transferred, you got transferred. You weren't sent to the front. You weren't punished in any other way. But you'd probably have a few days before your transfer came through, and there'd be a bit of jostling in the lunch queue and a bit of sneering and back talk. And this was quite enough to keep school teachers and scoutmasters killing Jews all day. You know, no literary critic is going to be moved by that any kind of rhetoric. It's immediately another kind of phenomenon, but a literary tool that ignites this other thing, which is the crowd.
Yes, and presumably one of the things that informed the literary studies which we grew up with was to learn a way of reading that made brainwashing or indoctrination impossible, as though there was a part of oneself that could be mobilized such that one could actually evaluate the things that were said rather than simply be taken over by them or possessed by them. To get round this, I mean, because there's something sort of sadomasochistic about the scientific agreement, which is you must submit to this truth.
But it also has the other aspect of it. In politics, think of how often we hear politicians say, well, I don't know yet what we should do about this, but let's find out what the science says.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's find out what the science says, as if there could be objective measures of
or just the rhetorical agreement is that scientists are the people who know reality. So if we want to know reality, they're the people we talk to.
It's interesting, by the way, that in what we've been talking about so far, I've just realized, and I think there's a very good reason for this, we haven't really mentioned social science at all. Maybe it's because there isn't such a thing. I mean, one of the things I've been sorry, I mean, it's a very obvious example, but I think true, if it's not true, maybe. There have been various attempts in the last few weeks to identify practicing academic economists who expected or anticipated or in some way intimated a knowledge of the crisis we're now living through, the biggest economic crisis for several generations, absolutely huge. And people have come up with, I think, about 12 names. Now, there are thousands and thousands of tens of thousands in the world, but even in the English-speaking world, I would think many thousands. So why didn't... Now, you could say, well, they're not supposed to really predict things like that. That's what the astrologers do or the ship. But this is a big, gigantic change that we're entering into, or that we have already entered into. After all, is it not striking and paradoxical that large parts of the American financial system should have been nationalized by the Bush administration? I would say that's pretty paradoxical. Is it not
paradoxical? And unpredicted.
And wholly unpredicted, and it's all happened within about a few weeks. I looked at a few figures the other day. The projected cost of existing bailouts is now significantly, for America, I mean only, significantly in excess of the entire cost of American participation in the Second World War.
It's bigger than the Marshall Plan,
yeah.
The New Deal.
Louisiana Purchase.
Louisiana Purchase, all combined.
It's absolutely vast, and only a few, there are one or two who sort of close, and one or two practitioners, I should say, who anticipated something like this. Buffett talked about derivatives. Soros was on several. They're practitioners, much criticized often by economists.
But also the tremendous investment in prediction.
Yeah.
I mean, this is also partly the legacy of a certain kind of science, which is, I mean, even if one person predicted it, we're assuming that they have some mystical connection with the universe, the social universe. You know, why we should value predictability at all is itself quite strange.
Remember what Galbraith said? He was asked, why do economists predict things? He said, to make astrologers look respectable.
Interject here and ask people in the audience if they would like to participate in the debate. We've got some radio mics. If the people who are operating them can come and pick them up, please. And I'll just direct them round the hall. Have you got yours on? Perhaps you can go to that gentleman there. Thank you.
I'd like to go back to something that It was at the start of the discussion, which is what makes literature different from science. Science progresses, literature doesn't. But in literature we have innovation. Martin Amis is a novelist, clearly is a stylistic innovator. Now, is innovation just a kind of fashion? Or is it possible that innovation in literature is some sort of response to objective conditions? Also, innovation, V.S. Naipaul, we argued recently, has a flip side in exhaustion. He sees the novel as being exhausted. Is that some sort of response to objective conditions on a par with the way in which, you know, it's simply a fact that wheat cannot be grown in Tibet?
Well, I would say that the often turns out to be nothing new. I mean, originality and talent are the same thing. I think that's true. But supposed breakthroughs are often nothing of the kind. For instance, William Burroughs's cut-up method, where the author types out a bit of regular prose and then snips it into bits and hurls it up in the air and creatively reassembles it, was practiced in the 13th century by an Italian theologian, and it was called Ars Sicendi, Art of the Scissors. He flourished in the 13th century. I think there are responses, or maybe intuitive anticipations of objective conditions, in postmodernism, for instance, where writers started not telling you stories, but telling you how they were going to tell the stories. And architects made buildings where all the plumbing was on the outside, and etc. Now that didn't. It turned out to be not such a productive side road for literature, I think, but it, with tremendous predictive power of how things like politics would be conducted, with politicians telling you that, oh, this is my time for the one-liners, and telling you about how their pollsters are tracking your response, and suddenly the plumbing was on the outside. But I think, it's a truism that, as Adam said, literature does not improve. What it does is go on being there and providing the model. And I don't think whatever happens, it's been said that reading, been established fairly recently, that reading actually alters the physical properties of the brain. Someone who doesn't read has a different brain, detectably different from someone who does, and they think that the digital world is going to have similar effects on those who use it. That it'll refashion the brain. But I think it's my feeling that there will always be books and there will always be novels, because people need stories and all that. But it's because it's the ideal way to commune with yourself. And I think when you're growing up, the age of 12 or something, you suddenly realize that you start keeping diaries and notebooks, writing poems perhaps. But what you're doing is communing with yourself in a new way. And there's a sense in which the writers are just the people who never got over that and have gone on doing it all their lives. But the book is a sort of conduit to self-communion, and I think that is a human characteristic, the need for that.
Just a brief, what little I know about the invention of reading is that it was opposed by some people because it shortened memory. Prior to the development of reading, what we now think of as poems were more like songs. They were learned, like the Iliad. Not produced by one poet, but by a whole group of bards, and that, I think, went right into the 20th century in parts of
the Balkans. So what sort of was lost by reading according to... And the Buddhist scriptures, at least the original ones, were all learnt by heart, is something was lost. So that is a sort of an example, in a way, of a way in which some kind of cultural innovation can, as you say, Martin, fundamentally change the human organism. Not only in changing the brain structure, but changing the role of memory in life, because previously everything had to be learned by heart.
Sartre said that genius is the word we use for people who get themselves out of impossible situations. And it seems to me there is something in that, that there is an improvisation when somebody finds themselves in a situation in which the resources they previously had no longer work for them. So there has to be a new solution or a dead and old solution. And they're improvisations, but of course whether they're always considered to be better, so to speak, or any kind of progress, will depend upon the consensual criteria in the culture.
Okay, any more questions? Person at the back there.
Yeah, I'd just like to get back to this question at the beginning, which was raised about sort of distrust between the two sides and where this distrust of science comes from. There still seems to be an obsession outside of science with the mythology of eugenics and the Nazi use of science in quotes and Stalin's use of it. And it doesn't speak to actual science about what science is, but still there is this obsession with science. And we've already heard that the discrepancy is rather a case of ethics and politics not being able to progress while science does progress or accumulate. So it seems to be a complete category mistake. Why are we still blaming science, and why are we still suspicious of science? We've heard phrases like the black mass of science, and you're talking a lot about pseudoscience, and pseudoscience is just not science. Why are we not balancing the blame a little bit and talking about the animalistic and the human, and that being the area of problems, not science itself? There's a similar sort of parallel analogy of if science is a thought experiment that sort of says if science came up with found a murder gene, a gene which said that we were a certain person who had it was going to commit murder, then science wouldn't be able to tell us what to do about that. It wouldn't be able to tell us whether we should put that person in jail before they murder, or jail them, or blame them, or if we should exonerate them, or not blame them for committing murder. And it's because there's no ethical level to science that we are distrustful of science. And it just seems to be a category mistake, because that's not what science does. And yet it's forever blamed for kind of unethical uses of it. And I'd just like to sort of throw that back.
Well, it's a very dramatically simple way of resolving a lot of problems to say that something is a category mistake. It's a bit like if you talk to Christians of various types and you would say, you know, well, hasn't Christianity or religion been bound up with all kinds of repressions? Well, that's not true religion. The Inquisition wasn't Christian. How could it be Christian? It wasn't loving. In other words, there's the background that we actually know what science and pseudoscience are, but the key thing about most of the things we now regard as pseudoscience is that they were accepted not just by the Nazis and by Stalin, but by most of the scientists of the time as science. Racist anthropology was generally accepted by most anthropologists working in the time before the First World War and in the 19th century. What made it pseudoscience? We've decided, I would say rightly, but it is a decision that was a type of pseudoscience, and we can give various reasons for thinking that. But it's never completely unproblematical what is science and what isn't. And the reason people claim that various political projects are backed up by science is a rather simple one, but a powerful one. It's that science is one of the few institutions that still has authority. In other words, if you say that something is scientifically demonstrated, people don't say, well, I disagree. I just don't accept that. Very rarely is that what people say. You've presented them with something which, if they agree that it was scientifically demonstrate is a conversation stopper. So I don't think this is a category mistake at all. I think the whole question is how we distinguish between these categories, and I think that's actually very difficult.
I also think there's a more reductive answer to the question than that, which is that I think people also feel about scientists the way they feel about their parents, which is the good bits of parenting are taken for granted and the bad bits are held onto as grievances and frustrations. I think most of us take the good bits of science for granted and we're very happy they're anesthetics and so on. And the bad bits we demonize, and we demonize scientists only because, and A, because some of them have done terrible things, but also because what they do is recondite to most of us. We simply don't understand it. So when we go and have a general anesthetic, we don't go through all the experiments that have been done to find out how anesthesia works. We just entrust ourselves to the anesthetist. This is a tremendous act of trust. And it's true of an awful lot of science. Most of us cannot possibly understand it, either because we're not brainy enough or because we haven't got the time. And I think it isn't weird that we therefore demonize, not based on no evidence at all, but we demonize a lot of the people who do things we don't understand, who have a great deal of power, as we did in our families.
And, you know, suspicion of science is not suspicion of science per se. It's that human beings and science are an unsteady alloy.
Anybody else? This gentleman on the side here.
I was interested in, is it Dr. Gray or Professor Gray's reference back to the Greeks? Because my study of the Greeks leads me to believe that that was the highest civilization we've yet achieved. We've never surpassed Aristotle. And Aristotle would have said, no human being who isn't a citizen, a full participating citizen in his society, can call himself human. One of the, who said, a man who is deprived of free speech is a slave. And all these kinds of ideas are central to any notion of a full humanity. The reason we distrust scientists is the same reason when Einstein was corresponding with Freud. Freud said to Einstein, oh, the masses, I am so afraid. They are so easily led. They will do anything you tell them. In letter, anyway. And Einstein replied, you don't need to fear the masses. It's the intellectuals. The intellectuals are the sheep. Any idea, they follow blindly. And they do. I say it every day. I was in the Labour Party. I saw them elect what Matthew Paris calls a psychopath. Tony Blair took hold of a party and willfully destroyed it.
Could we perhaps stick to science and literature? Yeah, it's a little bit off the point.
It comes back to this notion that if you have an elite and they can use the power of science against the vast majority of the population, they indeed will, and they do on a daily basis.
And what do our panellists think of that?
I think Aristotle is a very interesting person, a very interesting thinker to consider in these contexts, because you're absolutely right in certainly one respect, which is that Aristotle thought of himself and was seen by others as a scientist. He was empirical. For example, if you want to read about ethics outside the human species, Aristotle talks about dolphins. It's not something which has just been invented by animal liberationists in the last few years. He talks about the virtues of dolphins. He talks about what a good life for dolphins is. So there's all that in Aristotle. But at the same time, and this is where I think this issue of what science and what isn't, or in the case, what's theoria, what's knowledge and what isn't, what's philosophy, and what's mere prejudice, you have, of course, in Aristotle, a defense of slavery, the argument that women can't actually be philosophers because they're inferior, non-Greeks. I mean, it's very, very few human beings get into this category of fulfilled human beings, who are even potentially fulfilled human beings for Aristotle. Tiny, tiny group. And the reason for that is not just that he was prejudiced, as no doubt he was, but it's that he had a picture of the world which was hierarchical. That's to say, things in the world were ordered into a kind of metaphysical hierarchy, and humans were in one category, some humans were in another category. Philosophers, unsurprisingly, given that he was one, and male philosophers, there were only male philosophers, were in a very an even smaller category, etc. So it was a tiny, tiny... And by the way, you couldn't get in the top category if you engaged in trade or agriculture. You had to have a private income, which is why Alistair MacIntyre, rather unfairly perhaps, but humorously said, you can hear his Aristotle's Etonian drawl. Perhaps rather unfair there. But the serious point is the view of a hierarchical universe science, or is it something else? Now, some people would say, well, you can distinguish between fact and value, ethics, and blah, blah, blah. I don't think it's easy at all to distinguish them in that kind of way, because Aristotle thought that he had a whole metaphysical theory of what was in the world, which carried with it various values. And if you were rational, you would accept the metaphysical theory. If you said to Aristotle, look, I think a person who spends his or her entire life without doing any philosophy can be a better person, have a better life than a person who does philosophy, Aristotle would just have to reject that, because the life of the first person is unexamined life, and the life of the philosopher is supposed to be examined. Now, you know, Aristotle would reject that, not just because he has a certain preference for the way of life he'd himself adopted or found himself in, but because he had a whole metaphysical view, which for him was science.
No.
I think we've got time for one more quick question. Gentleman down there.
I heard a lot about the totalitarian society here.
Can you speak into the microphone, please?
We can't hear you.
In the microphone, yes. I would like to put the record straight. I heard here a lot of totalitarian societies and the specific role of science in totalitarian societies. I have my personal experience of living in totalitarian societies, and I wish to emphasize that the principal servant of totalitarian society was not science. It was literature. It was art. When you now look at interesting political developments elsewhere in the world, for example, my educational research makes me to look at websites and blogs of so-called home school movement in the United States.
I think we
States.
Have to keep this quite short. Can you make your point in summary?
It is very interesting, and again, I wish to claim that still, I believe everywhere in the world, ideology, politics, life is moved not by people with scientific background. It is moved with background in humanities. And responsibilities for quite a lot of things which are happening and happened in the world lies not with people with scientific background. It lies with people with background in humanities.
Okay,
can we stop that there
and just perhaps put it to the panel? That if I understood this right, perhaps rather than there being some blame laid on scientists, perhaps it's laid on writers or people in the humanities.
Was it
a response to our speaker at the back who was talking about the culpability of science and the way that science is seen as something that's responsible for the bad things in society, perhaps. And how could you answer?
The difference between literature and science, one of the many differences, is that literature makes nothing happen. At least that's the idea. I mean, tell that to Salman Rushdie. But it's not supposed to make anything happen. And that is a real category mistake when people mistake a work of the imagination for, as Khomeini did, for a project financed by world Jewry to soften up the Muslim world for slaughter, i.e. that's the satanic verses in this view. But something has gone wrong, usually at the political end of things, when a novel makes something happen. That's not what it's there to do.
But isn't it also obvious that all human institutions, all human activities pretty well, can be used for purposes which are damaging? I mean, religion has often been used that way. I would even say literature often has. And one can say, so to speak, well, when it's used that way, in a sense, it's extraneous to literature. But I wonder about that. I mean, if you think of all the writers in the 1930s and 1920s, I'm talking about humanities writers, who were highly, and there were masses and masses of them, who were highly sympathetic to fascism and even Nazism.
Not just writers, not just intellectual businessmen.
Writers.
Yes, but also businessmen.
But lots of people were, in other words. And the point is, I think there's a sort of danger in, first of all, blaming any institution, be it science or a particular art or writing, but also in trying to exclude the complexity of the way humans interact with their institutions by saying, well, as religionists do about religion, that's not religion, that's the perversion of religion. Or that's not literature, it's the perversion of literature. Or that's not science, it's the perversion of science. Because that's true. It's true of absolutely every... I mean, all these human activities partake of the conflicts of those who've created them and used them. So none of them are innocent. That's all that I would say. None of them are innocent. And to pick one out and say it's innocent, whether it be science or religion or anything else, I think is a sort of obstacle to understanding.
Yes, or you just might ask, in any predicament, who would you like to talk to? I mean, if you have a heart attack, do you want to talk to a poet, a surgeon, a dentist? It seems to me that we're not choosing here, that these are, that it's much more about working out which bits work better where. And fortunately, there's a huge repertoire of ways of going into things. There's a whole repertoire of conversations. They're different kinds of conversation.
I think that's a good place for us to end. So it just remains to me to say thank you very much to all of you for coming this evening, and to let you know that our next event as part of Literature Live will be an event with D.B.C. Pierre, whose first novel, Vernon God Little, won the Booker Prize in 2003. And that's on Monday the 15th of December. Tickets available from the usual box office and details on the website. Now, it's a little unusual, but what I'm going to ask you all to do now is stay in your seats as I escort our panelists out of the hall, because we've only got one door here, and so that they can then take up their seats downstairs for the book signing in the foyer. There's a bookstall down there if you don't have books with you. And you're all very welcome to leave once we've actually left the back door of the hall there. And so finally, perhaps you'd all like to remain in your seats and join me in thanking our panelists in the usual way.